Hello and welcome back to the MJA podcast. I'm Kate Swanell. Stillbirth remains a taboo subject for many, even though the stillbirth rate in Australia remains steady at around 1 in 6 births. For Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women, refugee and migrant women, and other socio-economically disadvantaged women, the stillbirth rate is even higher. Associate Professor Jane Yelland from the Intergenerational Health Research Group at the Murdoch Children's Research Institute in Melbourne is my special guest today. She and her co-authors have written a perspective for the MJA, which details where the inequities lie and provide possible solutions to preventable stillbirths in migrant and refugee populations. Where are the equity gaps in stillbirth rates?
1 in 6 babies are stillborn every day in Australia, so while it's considered a rare outcome, that's really significant. And that equates to about 2,000 babies that are stillborn in Australia every year. The concern about stillbirth is that's a tragedy for families. It's a tragedy for healthcare providers. Mm-hmm. And the stillbirth rate hasn't changed in Australia over many years, despite a very good health system here in Australia. That's one of the reasons there's particular concern about stillbirth and a focus on stillbirth in Australia at the moment. But there are clear sort of socioeconomic disparities in stillbirth rates in high-income countries, not only Australia. There's disparities that people that are socioeconomically disadvantaged, the stillbirth rates are often double those of the more advantaged groups. And in some ways that's likely to be underestimated because it's sometimes quite difficult to determine anything more in the comparison because of smaller numbers between the advantaged and disadvantaged groups.
Who are the disadvantaged groups, Jane?
So the disadvantaged groups and those that are more likely to experience stillbirth in Australia are Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women, migrant and refugee background women, and women that have a low income and or have had low education or educational attainment. There are clear disparities, but of course there's diversity within those groups and diversity between the groups, and I think that's important to remember.
Are there physical or medical reasons why migrant and refugee women have higher stillbirth rates?
That isn't entirely clear. And of course, the reasons for stillbirth are multifaceted, and a significant proportion of stillbirths, the reasons for that stillbirth are unknown. So in up to 50% of stillbirths, deficiencies in care are identified, but in around 20 to 30% of those deaths, deficiency can in care are considered avoidable due to those factors. But we can see, and this is research that's been undertaken here in Victoria and actually internationally, that stillbirth rates by the country that women were born in, but particularly by maternal region of birth, has identified that some women from particular regions are at higher risk of stillbirth. And here in Victoria, one explanation for the higher risk of stillbirth amongst South Asian women, so these are women from that were born in India or Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Afghanistan and Bangladesh.
Yes.
Those women are at higher risk, and this is related to the difference in gestational length and fetal growth restriction.
Okay.
So that's population-based study here in Victoria. So, yes, there may be biological reasons, but they're likely to be ones beyond that that are related to migration per se and access to and the quality of antenatal care.
So what are the barriers to access for migrant and refugee women?
So there's really major challenges for migrant women of non-English speaking background navigating Australian healthcare. And that's been recognised for decades, I guess. And unfortunately, with no evidence of improvement in migrant women's experiences of maternity care, over population-based surveys that have been undertaken in Victoria and South Australia, So one of the barriers, of course, is obvious, and that's in relation to communication. Mm-hmm. So in a recent report here from the Victorian Consultative Council on Obstetric and Paediatric Mortality and Morbidity, they identified effective communication as one of the top five areas for action to safeguard the health of women, children and families, but particularly in relation to effective communication using interpreters.
Right.
And that really echoes numerous state government reports and national guidelines for care and recommendations made by researchers. So this is not an isolated call to action around communication. In the context of migration, particularly when people come from a country where English is not the main language that of that country, being able to access information in people's own language and communication with service providers is really paramount, and provides, in many ways, as a barrier to accessing care and navigating one's way around what is actually a very complex health system. Mm-hmm. Is a noted barrier, and having access to information is really critical here. So what might be less obvious is that access to care is really challenged when care is not responsive to people's context and needs.
Yeah, yeah.
So one thing's finding your way into the system. The other barriers are sort of systematic issues, I guess you could consider. So not having a professional interpreter when you need one. Care that's provided in a place that's difficult to access, mm-hmm. or not close to home, costs money. But also how, once people are in the system, how they experience care and whether they will go back to care, and how that impacts on people's future engagement and help-seeking sort of behaviour. So if you're being made to feel welcome in that healthcare setting, whether the providers are really interested in you as an individual, mm-hmm. Listen to what you have to say, taken seriously, and use words that you can understand.
Yes.
And I think overall feeling safe in the interactions that you have with your providers. So these are really critical components of communication and access to care for everyone, but particularly for people who may come from a country where English is not the main language, don't speak English or have low English proficiency, and may have low health literacy. So it's much harder to access information when you're stressed. The system doesn't support providers to provide the time and develop the relationship with women so that people feel that they can interact with the provider.
I'm chatting today with Jane Yelland from the Murdoch Children's Research Institute. Jane's co-authored perspective can be found at mja.com.au. There is also an open access article on Jane's work at insightplus.mja.com.au. That's insight, P-L-U-S, all one word, mja.com.au. Back to our chat. Does pregnancy present special issues for migrant and refugee women in terms of the trauma they might have gone through? Or
that's an important question. And look, for any family, pregnancy and having a baby is a significant life event. It's a critical time to ensuring a healthy start to life for infants. But women's social circumstances is a really important consideration here.
Yeah.
It's very well recognised that the number and type of stressful life events are associated with poor maternal and perinatal outcomes. And so in the context of migration and settlement experiences, people that come to Australia, particularly who come to Australia from non-English speaking backgrounds or humanitarian countries, source countries, experience social isolation and economic disadvantage, and that particularly noted stressors. But I think it'd be really good to consider refugees in particular, because I think it's really important to remember that people of refugee background that come to Australia are ordinary people.
Yeah.
They've found themselves in really extraordinary circumstances, yes. having to flee their home and country. And war is a really common experience for refugees. That comes with often significant experiences of torture and trauma as part of the refugee experience. And people face additional hardships around the time of pregnancy. So I think it's important to think about that context and those experiences and hardships about where people have come from and what they might have experienced as part of their refugee experience around the time of pregnancy is important for us all as members of the community, researchers, but particularly for health service providers and organisations to remember. So these are people that have often had experiences of multiple bereavements.
Yes.
Including having lost children
mm.
or experienced or witnessed the loss and killings, for example.
Yeah.
Disconnection from family members, which is, you know, contributes to social isolations. People may have come by themselves or come with one family member. Previously traumatic pregnancy experiences, possible history of sexual assaults or mm-hmm. injuries from torture or trauma. The country that people may have come from may have high infant and maternal mortality rates. And people may come with different understandings of health and illness, come very much sort of isolated from their culture. They're important considerations. Mm-hmm. And rather than present special problems for migrants or, in this case, refugees, an important, really important considerations in terms of helping people recover from trauma at the time of pregnancy, and certainly being mindful of providing trauma-informed care mm. that doesn't re-traumatise people because of what might be happening with them for them in the health system. Audio recordings of medical consultations as a communication strategy has been trialled successfully in oncology and primary care settings. The concept is gathering interest, particularly, I think, internationally, as a tool for enhancing communication, enabling people to have listened to recordings again, helping with informed decision making. And there's an indication that it reduces people's anxiety,
mm-hmm.
that people can share audio recordings with family members, but very much focused in the oncology and primary care settings.
Yes.
There has been one study here in Melbourne, actually, using audio recordings in interpreter-mediated consultations,
mm-hmm.
but that was also conducted in Victorian oncology settings. So those people, patients that required an interpreter, reported that they listened to the recording again after the consultation, and that increased their recall of medical information, their understanding of treatment and test results, and help them with the decision making. So there was also an indication that from that particular study that clinicians may adopt a more planned approach to consultations, knowing that their discussion was being recorded. So we suspect that this has salience in the antenatal space. And the reason being is that interpreters, you know, there's some services here in Victoria where there's a very high requirement for interpreter services,
mm-hmm.
up to 10% of women having a baby in metropolitan public hospitals here of refugee background. Some services, antenatal services, up to 20% of people attending those services require an interpreter.
Yeah.
So there's a high need for interpreters. I think about antenatal care, it's a very information intensive episode of care. So yes, there's a lot of clinical and schedule of clinical checks and procedures and surveillance. There's also an emphasis on a lot of what might be considered education and information sharing between client and clinician.
Mm-hmm.
There are certain requirements about what needs to be shared. So if you think about stillbirth, clinicians are meant to be telling women about sleeping position, for example, not smoking in pregnancy, what to look out for in terms of reduced fetal movement. The latter one's really important because people need to have information that they can understand and then act on in relation to reduced fetal movements. You have to be able to understand that information and then know where to go to if you're concerned, and know that when you go somewhere that you're going to get a response. And some of the things we take for granted, but for people with low English proficiency or may not have been in the country for very long, this is really important. And we've heard that people often don't feel they've had access to that information, or it hasn't been provided in a way that they can understand. So we think that by audio recording the consultation with the interpreter, that then women can listen to that information again in their own language and share that with their family members. That may assist women in terms of their decision making, in terms of going back and feeling that they can ask questions about the information that they were given. And it may well impact on the way that clinicians work with women, because this is, our proposal is a very sort of co-designed model, that this is being developed up with the community and with clinical staff and people in the hospital. So it's not just plonking in an intervention, it's an intervention that's being designed up on the basis of what the community want and what's going to work best for in the clinical setting.
Tell us about your group pregnancy care trial.
It's actually not a trial or an RCT. It was originally designed as an undertaken, implemented as a demonstration project being scaled up. The program's been designed to improve refugee background women, primarily's access to pregnancy and postnatal care, reduce social isolation, and improve health literacy. Very clear aims and very explicit design within those aims. It's been designed by the community, so the community told us what was important to them, but it's also been designed by the providers as well. So it's an integrated care model. It's a new approach to antenatal and postnatal care that involves a number of agencies collaborating together, and that's between public maternity hospitals, refugee settlement agencies, and maternal and child health services. And as researchers, we've been involved in facilitating that collaboration and evaluating it. So the program provides multifaceted and culturally appropriate sort of preventative health care along the lines I was just talking about in relation to antenatal care, about the sharing of information and support to refugee background during pregnancy and after pregnancy in a group setting. But it also provides clinical care. So women are also having their scheduled antenatal appointments alongside a group setting where pregnancy and postnatal information is shared amongst women and with the health provider team. So it's a cost-free program. It provides care and information that is very women-directed, going back to what I was just talking about in terms of the sort of schedule of things that need to be discussed with women. It's actually turning that around and getting women to tell the provider team what they want to know and to seek clarification and further information in a much more exchanged way of providing information. It's very culturally appropriate and it's in women's language. So in the group setting and in clinical space as an interpreter, but there's also a bicultural worker, comes from a similar background, high level language skills. And the bicultural worker is really pivotal in this space, in terms of working with the team of a nurse, maternal and child health nurse and midwives, but really pivotal to the engagement of women in the model. And it's set up in a way that facilitates links and referral to services as necessary. Sort of commenced as a demonstration model, which we evaluated with very positive findings. Women were talking about having access to information that was really important to them, knowing where to get help, when to get help and mm-hmm. where to get it from and how to do that. They really valued the level of continuity of care from pregnancy through to childbirth. So mm-hmm. in the main, maternity and early childhood care has been somewhat separated, working in different health silos, and this broke that down in a way so that women felt they had a more seamless journey. They got to know who was going to care for them and their baby and their family after the birth. It was really important to them, and they really valued getting to know other women. Overall, they felt that it was very safe, a culturally safe space where they felt they could really trust the care providers. It's being scaled up at the moment mm-hmm. With communities and agencies in Melbourne. So it's currently operating with Karen women that come from primarily from refugee camps from Burma yeah. and Myanmar, and Assyrian Chaldean women from Syria and Iraq, with plans for scale up with other communities and services. We're undertaking a fairly comprehensive evaluation of outcomes for women for the services and an understanding of the implementation processes.
Great. Thanks for your time, Jane.
That's a pleasure.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.